There should be some function in the middle of government that worships fair market value and refuses to allow things to happen that don't follow that creed.
A ministry of logic. We should have a ministry of logic. Mark, hello. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. You know what's occupying my mind is markups.
Markups. Okay.
Yeah. You know, what is a fair markup? Okay. So that coupled to the question of how long does it take for a banana to go fraught? Okay. Introduces me. Okay.
Aha. Now I see where this is going.
Yeah. And therefore, you have to make quite a good return on your bananas before they go fraught. Okay. So the one way that you can make an extraordinary return on your banana.
Right.
Is to get yourself a bit of duct tape.
Right.
Okay. Yes. Sticky tape the banana to the wall and get a Bitcoin billionaire to pay, have a guess, $6.2 million for the thing. And the good news is, the real good news, the savior of this stupidity is, I think it comes with instructions on what to do when the banana goes fraught. Okay. So this is a new thing. It's called replenishable art. And I have never seen such manifest stupidity evidenced by the human race. You know, I don't get it, Tim.
No. Here's where we part ways because...
You like it, yeah.
Yeah, because I'm all in favor.
Just before you do that, I'm off to Woolies straight after this, okay? And I'm going to buy, a watermelon, okay, and sticky tape it to the wall. Let's see if we can get to that. Now, what do you think?
All right, so we're talking about the infamous banana taped to the wall, which was made by this artist called Catalan.
Yeah.
And the artwork was called Comedian.
Yeah.
And it went on auction at Sotheby's last week, and it was sold to this...
Dustin Sun.
Yeah, billionaire. It's a crypto billionaire. He paid, of course, in crypto. But here's the irony of this whole thing, right?
I can't wait.
Yeah. Catalan was precisely criticizing the value of art. The artwork was a commentary on the value of art. So the banana is supposedly a symbol and to demonstrate how absurdly art is priced. So, you know, it's a joke within a joke. It's very ironic. The whole thing has just been a whole education and a joke on itself. It's meta. It's meta. It's great. I think it's fabulous. And I wish you very good luck with your watermelon. And I really hope it does well.
The trouble is it's too big. I've already tried and I put it on biddlebuy.com. So far, nothing.
Okay, nothing.
So we're going to be eating the watermelon. Okay, well, anyway, so much for that. So, but when you talk about fruit, you have to start talking about the price of fruit and you have to start talking about inflation.
Right.
And what is the basket of goods cost?
Right.
And have we been justly served by a 25-point basis reduction by the Saab in the repo rate?
Right.
And is it okay to have inflation at 2.8% while we're borrowing money at, I don't know, somewhere between 8 and 10%. Surely the highest ever real rates we've experienced, Tim, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm very interested in this because I basically think that our Reserve Bank walks on water. They're really in a period of enormous flux around the world. You know, they've just been fantastic.
I agree with that.
I mean, they really have been fantastic. Yeah, we could have been Turkey. We could have been, you know, Argentina, to name the, you know, just a few of the countries that really just went completely off the wall. And these guys, they held the ship to the course and they just kept going. And, you know, you can tell they were good because they started increasing interest rates before everybody else around the world. So they saw inflation coming before banks around the world did. And, you know, banks around the world have almost gone up in, you know, sort of tandem and boom, boom, boom. We've gone all the way from around about 3% interest rates to now, we sort of peaked at 7.75, right? Mm. And we're now 7.25. But the point is that when interest rates were 3%, the inflation was 2.5%.
Yeah.
Inflation has gone back to that in South Africa. We're now at 2.8.
Yeah.
And interest rates have not come down in the same way that they went up. which is why, as you say, there's this big gap.
No, nothing gets past you, Tim. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. We've got the highest differential ever. Now, never mind the repo rate, because those of us that buy bananas for resale don't give a rat's about the repo rate. What we give a rat's about is, you know, the cost of food, okay? Now, this is a either or. This is not all of the above, or maybe. Are you for or against inflation and why?
Well, I'm against inflation.
There's no buts allowed.
I would have been in favor of a bigger rate cut. So don't tell me you're in favor of inflation.
I'm not in favor of inflation. I'm against inflation.
You're against inflation.
Of course, everyone's against inflation. But you have to be aware of the real interest rate for the people that are using money to buy things. Forget about the rate that banks can borrow money from and all of that stuff. I mean, what's prime at the moment? I forget, but it must be about around 10% still.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got a borrowing rate for the man in the street 3 times inflation. You can't borrow money at 3 times inflation and buy anything with it that you consume, surely. Yes. So, and also, the last point I'll make is, so we had a guideline. We had a range, 3% to 6%, I think it was. We got out of the range. We're below the range.
Yes.
So I'm not saying that they're wrong, but I'm saying it's a little bit, you know, it could have got some more, okay? We could have got like a full 1% in my view. Okay, a little bit more, you know? I mean, the kids have been good. Can they not have an ice cream after the game of rugby? You know, that's all I'm wanting. Maybe oranges at half time, you know, something.
Yes. Okay. Bananas. Yeah. Everybody likes bananas.
Well, bananas are very expensive, as it turns out. You know, you should never. You're not going to willy-nilly see tennis professionals eating a banana during the break. No way. Yeah. Sell it for more than the price.
The interesting thing is they actually lifted their, we're talking about the MPC meeting last week, and they lifted slightly their inflation expectations for over the medium term. So basically that's why they're being cautious now, is because it's very difficult to raise your inflation expectations at the same time, you know, pull interest rates down. But it is really strange. I mean, I spoke to somebody, is this true? I mean, I spoke to a fund manager who said, you know, it's basically the cost of capital is too high in South Africa. And that is stopping businesses developing. And because businesses are not developing, we have an over-concentrated economy. And because we have an over-concentrated economy, there's not enough competition. And because there's not enough competition, the competition is what brings down inflation. And that's our problem, that we need lower interest rates in order to get business going, in order to get competition going, etc. That sounds logical, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is logical with a slight different take. We have impacts on our cost of capital, which are not studied in books of economics.
Yes.
Okay. We have, you know, imposed tariffs and taxes in whatever guise and form they take themselves. And we have regulatory, you know, impositions, which are not driven by economics, but have a political, you know, foundation to them.
Yep.
And those inhibitors of return are what misprice our cost of capital, I would argue. Okay, it's not so you can't have a pure economics discussion when you have certain things like there must be a 30% shareholding in this, and there must be a tariff against this, and there must be there's a construction mafia in this, and there's a leakage in that, and there's a maintenance, and there's a fictitious, if you like, NERSA, you know, Eskom price debate going on. Those are the issues which drive the uncertainty of our capital and make it abnormal and therefore expensive. The risks are what cause it.
Yeah. That's a point, absolute point. And talking about the businesses, you used to be the postman, Pat.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you've noticed, but the post office is back. They've just, their debt has disappeared. It's just been amazing. Would like to comment on that.
It's miraculous. You know, yes. I mean, one minute you owe 8.7 billion and the next minute you owe 400 million. And before that you had 9.5 billion of debts and now you've got 400. This cannot happen in the real world.
Yes. Okay?
You cannot, in a company that's under business rescue, noch al, repay 9 or so billion of debt. There's only one way you can do it, is with a pen.
Yes.
And that is by cancelling the debt perforce. you know, commonly otherwise known as a creditor compromise. Okay, so someone has paid for it, but it's not the post office. And this is something which I might want to investigate in other entities like SAA and whoever's sort of miraculously got rid of their debt burdens when there's no obvious economic source for repaying that debt, has done so with the stroke of a pen. Now, that's not, you know, unique to public companies or SOEs. In fact, it's a common practice. You get a Section 311 creditor compromise, and that's, you know, what you do. The thing that makes this different is that this is an organ of state. Okay. Now, how can an organ of state, I ask you, enter into a creditor compromise with its people? It presumes that the state cannot meet its obligations.
Yes. So, you know, basically what they've done, if I understand it correctly, they've stiffed their bondholders, right?
Yeah.
They had some debt, and now they've basically said to their debtors, we are going to pay you 10 cents in the rand or something like that for the debt, and we will have no debt on our balance sheet.
Yeah.
That's good news for us. The bad news for you is that you thought you had an asset in the sense that we were going to pay back this money, and now we're not.
Yeah.
So the loser here is anybody who bought the post office's debt, right? And that would be, you know, pensioners, because a lot of this debt was underpinned by state pension funds or other pension funds. We don't know.
No. I think it might have been slightly different. I don't want to delve into this post office specifics, but,
right,
you know, a lot of the state entities that borrow money do so under the auspices of a treasury guarantee.
Correct.
And so then that's a slightly different debate.
Right.
So I think the creditors are just normal common or garden creditors where you haven't paid your lease, where you haven't paid, as you say, your medical aid hasn't been transferred across to the service provider. You haven't transferred the member's contribution into the pension fund. You haven't met SARS's bill, which that's in another heading by itself again. It's all your creditors. I mean, the post office, certainly when I left there, by the way, had no debt, okay, at all. Okay. In fact, it had 5 billion or so of cash. And so, you know, whatever debts you've built up or money that you've lost, if it is not to a state
institution
entity, then it is somewhere funded by the public or the institutions. Yeah. And the state has essentially reneged on its debt via the SOE. I'm not talking legally now. I'm talking morally.
Yeah. It's a different kind of bailout, isn't it? In the past, the bailout would happen via the taxpayer. So now government's got sick of that. They've got sick of the idea of bailing out SOE with their cash holdings. So now they're doing it differently. They are stiffing creditors.
Yeah, well, the providers of funding. I do.
The only problem with that, just tell me if I'm wrong. You know, I'm much more about this than I do, obviously. But you can only really do that once, right? I mean, this is the disadvantage. Because no one's going to lend you money now. If you stiff your creditors, then no one's going to be insane enough to give you another loan, right?
Well, you know, there is sometimes an economic case to be made for saying, listen, there's a real business here. We've had a major catastrophe of one sort or another, and that catastrophe is behind us, and we're either going to go and solve it,
right,
or we're going to do a compromise to all of the creditors, and we're going to start again. But there's this opportunity to make money in the future. Now, that doesn't apply in the case, I would argue, of the post office. I'm not sure about SAA and others. But yeah, it certainly impairs your creditability and your creditability.
Yes. Okay?
I find it as a notion that an organ of state enters into a creditor compromise or defaults on any debt obligation. I find that in a completely different category. Now, having said that, if you go specifically onto pensions, I saw now that the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FSCA, has commented recently that there are arrear pension fund contributions in the aggregate totaling 5.2 billion. Okay. Now, that is not just a commercial discussion, that's a criminal offense.
Yes.
That is taking members' contributions who you have received and not paying them over to service providers or pension fund administrators, and that, as a board of directors, in my view, is a criminal, if not morally, you know, reprehensible act.
Right.
And so what's going to happen, Tim? I'll give you a summary of what's going to happen. How many words would you like my summary to be?
Just one will be fine.
Nothing.
Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. And that speaks to the immunity that we have evolved about numbers and failure. So we listened to a number. Oh, yeah, there was the 5.7 billion lost, and then this was 40 billion. Yes. And everyone's numb to it. It doesn't warrant or doesn't seem to get a secondary analysis. It's just taken. It's a terrible. There should be someone sitting in a box somewhere in the middle of government who tick boxes the rational reasonableness of any conclusion or pronouncement and says, guys, it's wrong to hand out the matric papers for printing at 3 times the government printer cost. We can't do it. Guys, right. You can't pay this. There should be some function in the middle of government that worships fair market value and refuses to allow things to happen that don't follow that creed. You've got me going.
You could say a ministry of logic. We should have a ministry of logic. Sure. But just can I just delve into this, because I also saw this same press release. And if I understand it correctly, what's happened here is that, you know, we've moved to this two-pot system. So you can take out some of the cash that's sitting in your pension fund, but you can only do it once. And that's all going to happen now. It's absolutely great. So there's been a lot of applications to take some cash out of pension funds, right? So in the process of doing this, they have discovered that, you know, quite a lot of municipalities are not up to date with their pension payments. So here is my question for you, Mark. There are 257 municipalities in South Africa. How many of those 257 are not up to date with their pension payments?
No, this is a loaded question. I'd say surely not more than 50.
149.
Yes.
Basically, two-thirds, if you want to put it that way, two-thirds of South African municipalities are not up to date with their pension payments.
This is not paying contributions over to the pension fund, this, or is it?
Yes.
Or is this not paying pensioners? That's what it is. Not, okay, yeah. Well, they all stand accused.
No, they are in arrears in their contributions to their own pension fund.
They stand accused because they've been extracted. Is that the employer's contribution or the employer and the employee's contribution? We don't know, okay?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Okay, because if they've not paid across the employee contribution, that is theft, manifest theft, okay?
Yes.
And if they haven't paid the employer's contribution, that's manifest fraud in my view, okay? So here's the question. I mean, who discovered this and does everyone know what they're doing?
Yes. So the largest municipality, the municipalities with the biggest arrears are in the Free State, and they are about 1.4 billion rand in arrears. So I don't know what the Free State budget is, but I think they're going to have a lot of trouble finding 1.4 billion rand to just square up their pension payments.
Yeah, so some guy, it's interesting. How the two-pot system has been the identifier or the reckoning of this, because you pitch up and you go, how's it? I'm going to have some of the money. They go, just hang on a second. We're just checking. No, the money isn't there. Bad luck.
Wow.
These checks and balances, it's about time they got discovered. Listen, I have a problem with the two-pot system anyway, because I think to borrow from your future while you're still economically potentially active or actually active, to steal from a time when you won't be and pay a higher rate of tax than you would then is just, I know people saying, oh, but they've got to buy food. And they go, well, then the causes are what have to be addressed about employment and so on. But if you could possibly avoid it, and also, by the way, it's a regulatory tax collection scheme, a regulatorily imposed tax windfall, okay, at the expense of, in particular, those who aren't, I would argue, not fully conversant with the present value of money and the risks of what they're doing. Again, I think it's wrong, fundamentally wrong.
I mean, it's more than wrong. It's part of the same sort of tendency of municipalities to just decide not to pay their electricity bill to Eskom. Just decide not to. And then no one does anything. You know what I mean? You can't, which to me is, sort of kind of trebly shocking.
The real consequences are that everyone then says, well, if they're not paying, why should I pay? And then the whole thing,
exactly,
you know, escalates into a chamois. And so someone at some point, and goodness, we must be motivating South Africans today. Hey, we are the go-to happiness show. Okay, that's us. Yes. If you're not feeling good, yes, listen to the Tim and Mark show, and you're bound to feel worse. Okay, that's not what we do, Tim. They told us we're supposed to cheer people up, mate. Haven't you got something nice to say?
Yes, please. I do have something. What country has the tallest people?
Oh, I know. There's those guys that jump up and down. Well, you know, the sticks, eh? Isn't it? And the red.
No, unfortunately, the data that I've got is only for the countries in Europe. Okay, the tallest country in the world is the Netherlands. They're the tallest people. But you know what's interesting? What I find is interesting about this. Do you know who the tallest women are in Europe?
It's just escaped my mind.
They're also from the Netherlands.
There's a certain logic to this.
No. They're also from the Netherlands. So Dutch women and men, are both the tallest. And they are taller by a big margin, which is kind of interesting.
There's a consequence which I know is going to. I know this is going to surprise you, Tim.
Yeah.
But if you get a tall man,
yes,
okay, and a tall woman,
yes,
and they make a child, the odds are that child's going to be tall. Okay. So
Jesus.
So it follows fairly logically that if you've got the tallest men and women, right, you're going to have the tallest children, Butch, and it's going to keep going like that. And in fact, if your child comes out a shorty, you're going to ask who was doing what when. Okay.
Mark, that's my happy news for the week.
Enough already. We've cheered everybody up enough.
Enough already.
Yeah. Okay. Next time. Next week.
Good one.
Just it.